everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, episode 258. My name is Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Packet Loop, which is an Australian startup doing some really interesting things with packet capture analysis. It is big data security analytics, as they call it. It is very interesting stuff, and we are thrilled to have the support of a local startup here on Risky Business. And we will be chatting to Packet Loop co-founder and CTO Michael Baker later on in the show about roughly what they're doing. There's about five guys working on this, and it's really starting to take shape. And Packet Loop is also sponsoring our coverage of RuxCon Breakpoint next week. Just head to risky.biz/breakpoint throughout the week for all of our Breakpoint coverage. With big thanks again to Packet Loop. And I'll be dual filing stories and audio for risky.biz and The Register. So there you go. On this week's show, we're chatting with Kevin Mitnick, arguably the world's best known hacker. Kevin used to be a very naughty boy, and that meant that he went to prison a few times, unfortunately for him. But since his most recent release, which was over 12 years ago now, he's established himself as a security consultant, author, and globe-trotting public speaker. And we're chatting to him this week about the fundamentals of identity verification. How can you be sure that that person on the phone requesting a password reset is really your customer? Can you rely solely on static identity information in this day and age? Or should you be moving to two-factor? And where does two-factor get you anyway? Does that just shift the authentication burden onto someone else who can't really deal with it? It's a very interesting chat, and it's coming up after the news. Speaking of which, it is time to get into the news now. We're joined by Adam Boileau from Insomnia Security in New Zealand for a look at the week's news headlines. And first up, Adam, we're going to take a look at a story about a Canadian intelligence officer who some time ago was arrested for espionage. He's in fact pleaded guilty to selling Five Eyes intelligence to Mother Russia.
Indeed, yeah. This guy is Jeffrey Delisle, was a guy we talked about, I think, some time ago when he was picked up. He'd been selling intel to the Russians since something like 2007, and he's actually just pled guilty. And some interesting numbers have come out as well about how much money he was being paid by the Russians to, you know, let them into the middle of Five Eyes, which was a lot less than I was imagining. Yes. He was making something like 3,000 Canadian a month.
Yeah, which I'm thinking is probably less than some of Stratfor's premium products. And I think I know where I'd rather... I think I know the information that I'd rather be getting for my $3,000 a month.
Well, exactly, yeah. So he's potentially facing a very long jail sentence. I believe what life is what the worst case is. We'll have to wait and see how he gets sentenced. But yeah,
well, it's kind of like treason, you know, like it's a pretty serious charge.
Yeah, it is pretty serious business. But yeah, so he's pled guilty, and we'll see what he gets sentenced to.
Yeah, well, I think the one thing that we've learned out of this whole thing is that Russia drives a pretty hard bargain.
Well, yeah, they had, you know, pictures of his kids and stuff to entice him to continue feeding them intel. So, yeah, moral of the story is maybe don't so much walk into the Russian embassy and offer to sell out your government.
So, yeah, $3,000 a month and we won't kill your children.
Yeah, that's not really a great bargain. I would not buy that on Amazon.com.
No, but pretty good from the Russian side, I would imagine. Value plus plus. Now, speaking of all things spooky, there's been a congressional report in the United States that outlines a whole bunch of reasons why Huawei and ZTE are not to be trusted. What do you think of this, Adam? Because it's been the most comprehensive thing that the public's been able to have a look at with regards to Huawei, and it's certainly generated a bunch of headlines.
Yeah, it's got a lot of column inches, and it's of course a much more nuanced story than is getting played out in the mainstream media. The House Intelligence Committee chairman came out and said a bunch of very, very strong things. Like, he said, if I were an American company today, I would find another vendor. If you care about your intellectual property, if you can care about your consumers' privacy, and if you care about the national security.
If he was a company, I mean, that's kind of an abstract concept, isn't it? It's like saying, if I were a jumbo jet...
it's a pretty clear and unequivocal statement from them, and of course the report is not clear and unequivocal, right? It's pretty vague, and of course there is a confidential annex that classified annex that we don't get to see. But the implication is you shouldn't use Huawei equipment in the middle of your telco because the Chinese will hack you, which, you know, I didn't really need a massive report to be told that the Chinese want to hack me. I mean, that's just it's the fact of life. And the story is, has become so political, I think, right? I mean, the it's much more about economic competition between the US and China more than it is about the specific intelligence or specific cyber aspects of it. I think.
I don't know. None of us know. That's the point. You know what I mean? It's classified intel that we don't get to access, so we don't get to make an assessment on its veracity. It's just one of those things where there's no possible way we can make a sensible judgment on this.
Well, I mean, I think we can look at the larger context, right, which is that you don't need to sell equipment to a telco to be popping up in the middle of it, right? And all the equipment that we already use already has lawful intercept capability subject to poor oversight and all that kind of thing.
I think the problem, as I understand it, is less to do with, possibly, backdoors in equipment and stuff like that. It's more about the fact that Huawei is a Chinese company and operates in China, and thus is, when the Chinese government tells a company to jump, it has to say how high. So it's more that it could find itself under the influence of the state rather than rather than backdoors. I mean, the coverage has been infantile. I love that the guys from F-Secure did a blog post on this topic, which actually linked through to our episode 250, which was our interview with FX about how lousy Huawei security is. So they're sort of saying, well, look, regardless of the reasons, I think we've kind of dodged a bullet here.
Well, yeah, and I think that's certainly something you could take away from this whole exercise is, yes, maybe you don't want to run Huawei because the quality of the code is shit. Mm. And, Cisco presumably have spent a little bit more money and time in getting it right, or Juniper or whoever else. And, yeah, that's reasonable advice, I think, and the AFX's presentation certainly demonstrated that.
Mm-mm. Well, we're still waiting to see if he's managed to find similar issues in their full, carrier-grade stuff, but I guess we'll just have to wait until he announces that. In this next piece, Adam, which comes to us via CNetNews.com, the Philippines, the courts in the Philippines, the Supreme Court, has basically quashed a contentious cybercrime law that could have seen people getting up to 12 years jail for criminal libel for simply liking the wrong thing on Facebook. Glad to see sanity has prevailed.
Yeah, I think we briefly covered this law at some point in the past, and it was looking very poorly worded and quite typical sort of knee-jerky lawmaking without understanding the implications of it. And it's nice to see that within a day of it becoming law there, that the Supreme Court has suspended it for the next 120 days pending a review and that sort of thing. So it's it really did sound a bit silly, and that's obviously not what we really look for in law.
Jerky. Sorry. Yeah, well, it looks like sanity has prevailed there, and we'll just see if it gets revised as a new law with a different name, same sort of content. We'll just see what happens there in the Philippines. But for now, Filipinos who may be listening can rest assured that they will not go to jail for criminal libel for 12 years for liking something on Facebook. Now, Symantec has published a bit of a report that says Russian criminals have been selling access to these web proxies, but the proxy software itself is trojaned up the wazoo and makes you part of a big botnet. But these guys have been operating this sort of shifty VPN service with malware for quite a long time.
Well, I mean, I guess it's not a massive news flash that, dodgy pseudo security tool from Russia contains backdoor. But yeah, it's amazing that this thing has lasted for so long, right? I mean, that you could sell access to a commercial proxying service and have it be backdoored and actually, in Soviet Russia proxy through you, and not get busted, right? I'm surprised it's taken so long.
And they're talking about hundreds of thousands of users a year.
Yeah, I know, right? It's a surprisingly big scale. But then I guess we've seen, these kind of proxy services be used, against the user base for quite some time. We saw the FBI do it against in the Carters and the Carters Market takedowns and stuff, right? I mean, selling fake proxy services. So, I mean, I guess, if it works for the feds, it works for the Russian mob.
That was a masterstroke. I remember reading about that in Kingpin, where they're just like, yeah, you should totally use our clandestine VPN service, because everyone was using all these different VPN services, so it was impossible to figure out where they were coming from. So they just said, well, use ours. And
and you make $20 a month.
Yeah, exactly. You're basically funding your investigation. I mean, God, I just couldn't believe that people kind of went for that,
I know, yeah, it was a good move.
Great move. Inspired. Now, in the Middle East, some time ago, Google introduced a feature to its accounts where it would warn people if it detected, fairly obvious state-sponsored level attacks against an account. They've been having to issue a whole bunch of those warnings throughout the Middle East.
Yeah, I remember when this first came up and we started talking about it, and I said, well, you know, I think it's a good idea. And you countered that, well, you know, what are they detecting? What advice are they going to give? Like, what help is this really? And, you know, the fact that they are giving out thousands, or they're making thousands of these warnings, and we don't really have any idea of what they're detecting, you know, beyond the fact that there's lots of it, right, which I guess we already knew, does make it perhaps less helpful for the rest of us. I mean, you know, if you're logging into Google, you're seeing that maybe it is a useful piece of information. But, yeah, I'd love to see some more detail about exactly what they're detecting and what's going on, you know, and hopefully they will publish that at some point. But it's still,
you know, they may or they may not, because, you know, in this sort of game, you don't really want to give up too much intel on that. I mean, it's nice for you and me, but you got to assume that withholding some information about exactly what they understand about the MO of these attackers is probably sensible strategy.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I suppose I'm just nosy.
Yeah, you are. That's good. 80% hacker and now 20% journalist. So what a combo. Maybe you could be like that Julian Assange guy.
I could. I could totes be like that.
You could just set up a Twitter account and talk about yourself continuously.
Maybe dye my hair blonde, my beard blonde. That'd be sweet.
Yeah. Now, look, according to ThreatPost, Microsoft has patched a critical word vulnerability. Windows has also made some changes, some crypto changes, I believe, in light of... I think this is still linked to Flame somehow.
Yeah, so the first thing, I guess, the word bug is actually quite interesting. It's a bug in the RTF parser, which is actually used like in Outlook and Word and a whole bunch of other components of a SharePoint server. So it's actually quite a potentially bad bug. And word on the street is that it's not particularly difficult to exploit. I haven't seen a exploit for it yet, but I presume that one will turn up very quickly and people are expecting one. So that is definitely worth patching. The other aspect, which is the fact that Microsoft have chosen to start removing keys that are less than RSA keys that are less than 1024 bits, the conclusion that you would draw from that it is related to the Flame code signing thing that went on a while ago. They made some other changes to their certificate infrastructure around that time, and this is one, I guess, that took a bit more planning to actually sort out. But, you know, overall, you know, they're going to require a stronger RSA certificate key length, and that's something they're going to roll out now.
Now, Adobe has also issued some updates for Flash Player. I believe Microsoft was brought into the loop on that one as well.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of Flash bugs, nearly all of which appeared to come out of Google. Looks like some of the Google security crew have been warming up that old Flash fuzzer a bit more. Nearly all of the bugs came out of them. Good for everybody, I guess, getting more Flash bugs squashed.
Yep, free QA for Adobe.
And Note does not require source. I wonder if Brad Arkin's onto something.
Oh, now the deluge of Android malware continues, and apparently some of these guys are getting quite good at toll fraud malware. They're making some serious money, according to this piece.
Yeah, they're talking like numbers more than, $10 million a year for one particular gang, like toll fraud accounting for something like 90% of the malware seen on the Android platform, which is, I guess the obvious way to monetize things. We're also seeing, some development in the arms race between the malware authors and the token amount of, Android security vendors, things like obfuscation down at the bytecode layer and all sorts of recompilation tricks to try and make detection of these things a bit more difficult. Although, frankly, who runs antivirus or any kind of protection on their Androids anyway? So it makes you wonder why they need to do that kind of polymorphism and sorts of things.
Yeah, but it just goes to show you that the bad guys might in fact be ahead. I mean, Android, we've just watched this. We predicted this, and we have just watched it since early last year just unfold into being a pretty risky platform. And, Android, do not want.
I agree.
Would you run it?
I don't, right? I guess that says it. I mean, I'd like to run Linux on my phone. That would be sweet. But, I have to settle for a BSD or something.
Yeah, well, that's it. So, also Zitmo, so-called Zitmo malware's use in the mobile is apparently also affecting Android.
Yeah, we talked about it a while ago on the BlackBerry, apparently it's been turning up disguised as the Android Security Suite Premium lately because, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't, right?
And yeah.
You get Trojans one way or Trojans the other way.
That's right. Well, moving away from Android for a moment, and apparently the malware that was signed in that attack against Adobe recently was only used in very limited targeted attacks.
I don't see why that's a good thing. Like, they're saying, like, oh, it wasn't used, you know, in a widespread manner. Like, somehow that's better. You know, if anything, the targeted attacks are the ones that are much worse, you know, much less likely to get caught. So I don't think I'm particularly surprised by this.
Well, I think it's more an issue of putting a lot of people's mind at ease about whether or not, you know, this malware somehow slipped past, you know, typical enterprises' gateways and was used against them. So I guess what they're trying to say is that it was used against a small number of targets, and those targets mostly, you would think, if they know that it's a small number, might have been notified, might actually know that there's been an incident.
Well, yeah, but I think, you know, overall, the fact that their code's on Inbox gets owned is what makes me feel bad, not necessarily who it was being used against, and doesn't make me feel any better.
Okay, so, Adam, still not happy.
Still queasy in my bottom about Adobe products.
Yes, okay, right, there we go. Now, some interesting developments over there at Hack in the Box in Malaysia. Pinkie Pie has come through with another Chrome Zero Day, which is pretty awesome. Looks like he's one pwn to own with that. And also the Pirate Bay founders, who were supposed to be doing a presentation over there, have gone AWOL. Now, this, of course, in light of the arrest of one of the Pirate Bay guys, I think, in Southeast Asia some time ago. He was extradited to Sweden. So interesting goings on.
Yeah, so there was some breaking news I think I saw on Twitter maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes ago, which said that apparently one of the Pirate Bay guys had a stomach bug and didn't make the flight, and the other guy was advised by his lawyer not to travel out of Cambodia or wherever the hell he is at the moment. So they are apparently both safe and well and have not been abducted and taken to Gitmo.
Okay, well, that's I'm sure their family in Sweden will be relieved.
Yeah, if they follow Risky Biz for the latest news.
Yes.
Pinkie Pie's story, on the other hand, is pretty badass. His Chrome bug, I've seen a few details of it. It looks pretty sweet. Apparently it was a bug in the SVG parser, and then something else, the sandbox escaped from there. He chained together, I think, only two bugs this time rather than, you know, the 437 bugs it took last time. So clearly Pinkie Pie is becoming, more adept at this sort of thing, and we should fear his pony-powered powers.
That's right. Oh, now, there's been an interesting little what's been called an attack concept, which I like those two words together. This Stanford computer science student has come up with an attack concept which relies on the full screen application programming interface in HTML5 to trick users. It's kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah, this is really cool. I gave it a try, actually, and it works surprisingly well. His plan is basically that via the HTML5 full screen API, you can programmatically with JavaScript put the browser into full screen mode. And then what he does is, based on your user agent, figure out what operating system and browser you're running.
Yeah, and then figure out what to actually show you, so everything looks legit.
And then fake up screen Chrome so that it looks like you're still on your desktop and you're still going about your business. And, of course, then he can fake the URL bar, he can fake the the padlock or whatever the hell else, and make you think you're interacting with a real site. And the demo works really well.
Yeah.
And it's a cool concept. And I would be very surprised if we don't see this being used in the wild very soon.
Well, I mean, if you man in the middle someone, I mean, assuming they're not going for SSL straight off the bat, I mean, you've got them with this.
Yeah, well, I mean, even just clicking on a link, right? I mean, you know, you're on the site, you're clicking on a link, and, you know, it looks like the real thing. It works, yeah, surprisingly well.
But, I mean, you could put it together. You could put together, like, a server-side app in PHP or whatever that would, you know, intercept whatever URL someone's putting in, even if it's HTTPS, so you can actually display, sure, it's HTTPS, here's my padlock, everything's fine, but meanwhile it's SSL stripping everything in the background, but everything looks completely legit to the user. What can we do to defend against this sort of thing?
Well, in Chrome, for example, you get a little dialogue thingy that says you've entered full screen mode, or, you know, allow or exit back to windowed mode. That, I think, is probably the best that we've got at the moment. Safari doesn't appear to prompt you. I'm not sure what IE does. But yeah, the approach that Chrome has taken at least gives you some notification that you've gone full screen. There's also like a stupid little animation that Chrome does, and that kind of trips you, you know, tips you off that something weird's going on if you're, you know, the sort of person who's going to spot that. But I think that's what we've got at the moment. I guess Safari is going to have to add some kind of, do you want to allow this site to go full screen button as well?
Yeah. But interesting. And I think you're right. I think we will see that in the wild, because it's, you know, it's a way of kind of doing man in browser without actually having to infect the browser. I mean, you know, you could just, if you can DNS jack someone, you could do this. Like, it's just, there's a million ways to skin a cat with it. So
yeah. And it's very practical, very pragmatic.
Yep. Indeed. Oh, now speaking of trickery, Google's App Engine apparently is open to session jacking, according to a bloke named Matthew Sullivan, who is a graduate student at Iowa State University.
Yeah, apparently there was some part of the communications with App Engine that doesn't correctly force HTTPS the whole time, and you can, you know, essentially steal the session cookie and you know, kind of fire sheep style attack them if you're on the network, which is a good find. I'm sure Google will tighten that one up pretty soon.
Oh, now, there's a really interesting little piece on SC Magazine's Australian site written by Darren Pawley about some trickery that you can get up to with 3G networks involving sort of rooted femtocells and stuff. What did you make of this piece?
Yeah, so this is a presentation that's going to happen later on this month describing a couple of ways for doing user tracking with femtocells. Essentially, there's a couple of tricks where you can there appears to be a trick where you can decloak a phone's TIMSY backwards IMSY, which, you know, there's lots of telco jargon here that, you know, takes a lot of explaining. But the net result is that by using a modified femtocell, you're able to figure out whether or not a given person's phone is within the vicinity, and given enough femtocells around a place, you could figure out where someone was, which is not, you know, a world-ending attack. But there are a number of cases, you know, a number of specific places where that sort of thing would be a very useful thing to do.
Well, I like the way the SensePost guys roll with that, which is just to grab everyone's Wi-Fi Mac as they walk past, you know, as their device is screaming out for access points that it may know.
Well, yeah, well, obviously you can do similar sorts of things with both Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. So being able to do it against 3G is, you know, perhaps an incremental improvement in terms of actually how you would use it. But from a technical point of view, any sorts of attacks that are, you know, protocol layer, application layer sort of design things against the 3G stack have the potential to be, you know, quite widespread.
Well, it is cool. And, you know, I'm guessing that, you know, when your phone screens off and it's in your pocket, its Wi-Fi is probably not up anyway, or it's Bluetooth. So, oh, probably Bluetooth would be, wouldn't it, for pairing? I don't know. Anyway, it's better. You're right. 3G, being able to do it via 3G is better. Now, those of us living in so-called Five Eyes countries, being Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the UK, and the United States, we are very much familiar with the Cyberstorm exercises that take place, I believe, every 2 years. There's just been a similar exercise in the European Union with 3,000 InfoSec pros taking part.
Yeah, they apparently were drilling to deal with distributed denial of service attacks. They, you know, ran up their own botnet and threw some DDoS traffic around the place to try and get an idea of how they would handle that and mitigate it, which I guess is a useful exercise. You know, the important thing, you know, that we got out of Cyberstorm, I guess, and that, you know, they will get out of this really is understanding the personal relationships and getting the communication lines that you need to use during a crisis sorted out. Actually mitigating against large-scale DDoS, perhaps less interesting.
Now, a story that I know you're going to have a lot of fun with, CNET. CNET reports that a Twitter outage that left millions of people unable to tweet for about 40 minutes, one of the popular URL shortening services, or the, you know, the shortened Twitter URLs, were unavailable due to the actions of an Australian firm that I know you love. You just love this company because they're so competent and do everything so good.
They do. They do seem to get all sorts of things wrong, don't they? So, yeah, Melbourne IT is the domain register for .co, I gather. And at some point yesterday, I think, they yanked the domain t.co as a result of a phishing complaint. Now, if you use Twitter and you use you click on links on Twitter, you'll be familiar with t.co because that's Twitter's URL shortening service. So, yeah, they yanked the domain for about 40 minutes whilst, you know, after they got some complaint about it. And, of course, it broke everybody's links on Twitter.
Oops.
Yeah, that's pretty lol. So clearly whoever, you know, rolls with the abuse complaints department at Melbourne IT maybe doesn't use Twitter.
Maybe they've been sent away for some retraining as well after
this. Yeah, re-education. Maybe get their minerals reclaimed.
Now, we love a good lulzy story to end the news with, Adam. And although we're talking about a massacre, this is kind of a funny massacre.
It is. It's a funny, funny massacre. So the some hackers found a bug in World of Warcraft where they could essentially insta-kill people and non-player characters. And they went on a rampage around some cities in Warcraft, just killing everybody.
And there's videos.
And there's some great videos of, you know, like everybody spontaneously dropping dead and bodies falling from the sky and, you know, skeletons piling up in the streets, which, you know, were it not a virtual world, would of course be a complete tragedy. In this case, it being World of Warcraft. It's just funny.
It is just funny. It sort of reminds, do you remember when, I think it was like a live press event or something, in Second Life, got inundated with big wobbling flying penises? Do you remember that?
Well, it sounds inevitable to me. It's the sort of thing that would happen in Second Life. You know, it's all furries and ghosty men and flying cocks. But yeah, like really, if you're going to hold a press release in Second Life, what did you expect?
No, but do you remember that one? Because there's video of that too, and it is.
Yes.
It is. And I think someone set the video to the music, the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy. Just, something about it just worked. I think, you know, no matter who you were, no matter how conservative you were with those sort of things, I don't know anyone who didn't laugh at that.
Well, yeah, how good you know. You would be dead inside if you couldn't laugh.
That's true. That's true. Okay, Adam, that's actually it for this week's news, mate. We appreciate your time as always, and we'll chat to you again next week on the ground at RuxCon Breakpoint.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to it very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Big thanks to Adam and the Insomnia crew for giving him the time to actually sit around chin-wagging with me. Now, it is your last chance right now to take advantage of a special offer that is only available to Risky Business listeners. Next week at RuxCon Breakpoint, Rulof Temming and Andrew McPherson, the guys who created Multigo, will be conducting training. They will fly out from South Africa and they'll be showing participants how to do all sorts of stuff with the next generation of Multigo, which is Multigo Radium. It is serious software that you can use to do all sorts of serious stuff like data mining, target acquisition, reconnaissance. It is a Swiss Army knife for data, and this is extremely valuable training. Now, if you mention Risky Business when you register, you will get the early bird rate, which is about an $800 discount from the last minute rate. And this is a no bullshit offer. So go and register for the training at RuxConBreakpoint.com. I don't have any commercial interest in promoting this at all. It's just my opinion that this training is undersubscribed, and I think you're all nuts for not signing up for it. While these guys are here from bloody Johannesburg, get there, go and learn something. Anyway, it's time for this week's feature interview now with our good buddy Kevin Mitnick. Kevin is a renowned freaker and social engineer, but these days he is totes legit. His best-selling autobiography, which I have read and really enjoyed, is called Ghost in the Wires, and it chronicles his adventures as a social engineer over many years. Now, social engineering concepts have become topical lately, particularly in 2012. It was probably the owning of the Wired journalist Matt Honan. His Amazon, Apple, Twitter, and Google accounts got owned via social engineering, and that really put this stuff on the agenda. Now, this is something we've covered on the show before, but there have been other events as well, like the social engineering elements that were used in UG Nazi's attack against Cloudflare when they were trying to own 4chan. So in other words, social engineering is becoming a common vector for attack. We've long known it's a weakness, but it's really starting to be used by everyone, and people are starting to, you know, trade methods of operation and stuff like that. So long story short, we're going to be seeing more of this sort of stuff. So I thought it would be a good idea to have a chat to someone who really knows their way around fudging identities and social engineering. And in this respect, Kevin is without doubt the man. So I got him on the line and we recorded this conversation.
A lot of businesses, you know, especially internet service providers or, you know, Amazon, Apple, or whatever cloud services are out there, they usually, to verify you on the over the phone, you know, what do they have? Your name, your address, your payment method, maybe, you know, some smarter ISPs, like, you know, my sites are hosted with Firehose. They require like a password that you set up beforehand, which is the smartest way, I guess, of doing something. Of course, that password could be reset by going to their site and doing a password reset to your email. So if the bad guy gets access to your email, all bets are off. But a lot of businesses verify your authenticity by your payment method, you know, the last four digits of your credit card number. And I thought it was kind of, you know, sad and humorous at the same time that Amazon did not authenticate you before allowing you to add a new credit card to your account. So the process bug, as we all know, is simply adding a card, calling back, and then being able to verify the card you added, which is very simple. But another way that could be done even today, even if Amazon and Apple close these loopholes, is it's quite trivial, at least in America, to get somebody's credit report. They have these sites for, you know, like free, you know, annualfreecreditreport.com. And I think all three credit bureaus, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian in the States, allow you to get a free credit report annually. And the way they verify your identity is they ask you questions from your credit report. You know, what's your previous addresses that you lived at? You know, what county do you live in? Do you have a mortgage with this company? Do you have, you know, what's your car payment? Well, in a lot of cases, a lot of that information could be gathered, you know, through information reconnaissance. And the questions you can't answer, which is quite interesting, because if you, you do, it's a multiple choice questions. If you go to each of the sites, they'll ask you different multiple choice questions. Okay. And some of them will kind of be the same, might be the same question, you know, what's your mortgage payment? And you just compare the questions and the answers from all three bureaus, and you can kind of work out what the answers are. And in some cases, you could just answer none of the above. And then the credit bureau gives you some room for error, assuming, well, maybe you just changed your mortgage or your car payment and it is different. So we're going to give you the benefit of the doubt. And then the bad guy gets your credit report, and on your credit report is all your credit card numbers. So they could just simply leverage that to get access to these, you know, services at, you know, at their ISP and whatnot. So it's a huge hole in process. And
well, it is. And well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, all of this ties back to the concept of identity. I remember a couple of years ago, I was in this like sort of, it was like a brainstorming session with a few fairly interesting policy types. And we were just really talking about the fact that, you know, still today for the banks, it is quite difficult to make sure that they can, you know, they can't really eliminate mortgage fraud, because proving someone's identity, even when they're required to be there and provide 100 points of identification, is still difficult enough that there is mortgage fraud. So how can anyone be expected to effectively authenticate an identity remotely without actually seeing the person, when that person could be anywhere in the world? I mean, that's essentially the problem, isn't it?
Well, if we could solve that problem, Patrick, we can close down your show and we can become billionaires. Yeah. I mean, that's and I could close my business too. I mean, that's the $1 million question. Is it's already difficult to authenticate people in person, because especially like in Los Angeles, you could walk down the street like in Alvarado and Sixth, and this is near MacArthur Park and, you know, in downtown LA, you'll walk down the street and people will solicit you to give you fake identity documents like green cards and driver's licenses. And you can go in, they'll take a photograph of you, and they'll charge you $50 to $75, and you'll get a brand new spanking driver's license and any name you want. And that will usually work when you have to get something notarized, because they don't verify the authenticity of the identity under black light. Those type of identities probably won't work at TSA or for law enforcement, but you could leverage those simple fake identities to get permanent identity or real government-issued identity.
And hence what I was sort of saying about mortgage fraud before, which is there's your 100 points of ID, which, you know, purport to authenticate an identity even when it's a bogus one, but it still fits the process. I guess the point is the process when you're dealing with someone sight unseen is, you know, by its very nature, a lot weaker.
Right. I mean, and that's what it's been for years in the United States, is the identity process has been broken. I mean, back in 1971, Barry Reed wrote a book called The Paper Trip. I read it as a 12-year-old. I used to go to this underground bookstore as a kid and read all these books by Paladine Press and Eden Press. And one of my favorites was The Paper Trip. And it basically explained step by step of how to obtain new identity in America using a variety of methods. The most, you know, the hardest one to detect by law enforcement was the infant death method, where somebody would find somebody that passed away at a very young age and take over their identity. And that's what I did when I was a federal fugitive running from the government. And that's what made it so difficult for the government to track me by identity, by trying to compromise my identity. They did it through other means.
Now, just turning back to some more contemporary sort of social engineering and contemporary sort of notions of identity, do you think it is becoming more common that people are actively exploiting these process gaps?
The process gaps have been there for a long time, and I think it's become more public, because in the last, you know, several months to a year, it seems like a lot of these hacker types out there are wanting to expose their methods and expose personal documentation on individuals and businesses. So because of this new trend going on, now it's becoming public, but these process flaws have always been there. So I don't know if they're being used more. I think it's pretty much they're being publicized, because these kids, if you will, if you want to call them kids, want to get their street cred. So they want to expose business information and personal information, and also expose how they did it.
So they're kind of blowing their MO, aren't they?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, they're torching their method. You know, basically, you know, in my day of being a hacker, you know, you certainly didn't expose your method because then the method would be closed, right? And in this case, it's more important for the ego and the publicity to expose the method, you know, because that's what, again, these guys seem to be after is a lot of publicity and ego boosting.
Well, what I found particularly interesting about the case of Matt Hannon, the Wired journalist, was the fact that it was an attack that targeted multiple organizations and information that wasn't particularly critical, like the last four digits of a credit card number, solicited from Amazon could then be used to attack an Apple account. Without organizations actually really getting together and work out, you know, a uniform accepted way of verifying identity, what is critical and what isn't, how can CSOs who are listening out there actually harden up their processes to the point where an attack like the one that was perpetrated against Matt Hannon, how can they harden their processes so an attack like that would fail?
Well, the mistake here was with Apple. They accepted the last four digits of the credit card number as authentication, just like I mentioned earlier in the show. This is not just with Apple. This is with many organizations that, you know, provide services, because that they figure that your method of payment is secret, right? And I guess the best thing a CISO could do is add something to the process, like a password, you know, to the account. It's I'll tell you an interesting story, and let me digress here for a moment. I recently called one of my I have a credit card with a major bank, and I call up because I had some questions about my account, and the first thing the young lady asked me for is, "Sir, what is your password?" And I said, "Hold on a second, I'm thinking." And she goes, "Okay, sir, the password begins with an H and it's a place you would like to vacation." I mean, the lady's helping me with my password. I wanted to ask her, I said, "Well, can I buy a vowel?"
Yeah.
I mean, just ridiculous. So because of the importance of customer service and making it easy and not having the headache of password resets, these organizations want to keep it simple.
Well, that's what I was about to say. I mean, even if you give these guys a password, people forget passwords, and then in order to reset it, you're still falling back fundamentally on some very flaky identity information. So how do we get around that process problem?
Well, you might want to consider two-factor authentication, but then it becomes expensive, right?
But say that I ring up and say my token's not working. You know, I mean, aren't you still faced with that same problem, which is that, you know, verifying someone's identity. It used to be that we trusted people a lot more on the phone because we thought, well, you wouldn't trust input from a web form. But if they're actually ringing up, you know, it must be legit. So,
right, well,
you know, and not so much these days, right?
It's really how far are you willing to go? I mean, you could call the customer back at the telephone number you have listed for the customer, but what if the hacker changes that number? What if they, you know, get into the telephone company switch and call forward that number or convince the communications provider to forward that number? I mean, imagine all this out-of-band SMS authentication that's going on. Like, for example, Google, for their two-factor authentication, you know, you could have the application on your smartphone, but they'll also be willing to text you your PIN. You know, that changes every 60 seconds. Well, so what are we relying on here? We're relying on the security of the telecommunications provider. And based on my personal history with telecommunications providers, I'd be really concerned.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is really something that I wanted to get into with you because it seems that, you know, as you just said, like an obvious idea in order to verify someone is to call them on their phone number. I mean, that is something that is features prominently in so many sort of verification and reset procedures is pick up the phone and ring them, which means that your single point of failure is your cell phone provider's help desk.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, based on my knowledge of, you know, attacks that have happened, and some I can and some I can't talk about, it's not that difficult to, you know, to get the SIM ID of a particular user's phone and then convince the telco, you know, to temporarily change that SIM ID to a new one that the attacker has, and then to change it back, because all that is done in the switch. So somebody could either social engineer a switch tech or have access to the switch themselves. It's simple to do. So basically, they could hijack your phone, for the moment than set it back, because it's all in the telecommunication switch that provider is using.
Well, I mean, that's one technical aspect, right? But it seems, I mean, the really funny thing about all of this, right, is say that I'm a, you know, like an online shop or something, and I've shifted this authentication burden. I've said, well, look, verifying people's identities remotely is extremely hard. So I'm going to assume that this person's telephone has integrity and that the holder of that phone is the, you know, is the holder of this account. So then really what they're doing is they're pushing that authentication burden onto the telco. How is the telco in a better position to actually verify that person's identity? Because they can't just ring them and assume it's good, because they're the ones who are responsible for keeping it good. So how are they supposed to know? And you know, it just brings us back around in a gigantic circle to this whole question of verifying identity.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, then the identity verification process relies on the security of the telecommunications provider. And again, it's been my experience. I mean, if you read my book, Ghost in the Wires, I basically compromised all the phone company switches in America back in the 80s and 90s. So I had full switch access to everything. I mean, now you figure with the amount of resources and capabilities today that it could be done again, right? Mm. And especially with cellular phone companies, you can get a bad, you know, all it takes is getting access to the SMSC, right? And what is it? You know, it's a box running Oracle, right? To get people's access to people's text messages.
Sounds like a challenge.
Yeah, hopefully these companies are getting, are doing a periodic pen testing and really locking down their systems to, you know, a particular degree that's going to be, you know, make it very difficult for an attacker to compromise. But all these authentication methods are all based on what you know, right? So it's like a static password, and static passwords are, I believe, a thing of the past, unless you're using that static password access, you know, your account at the New York Times so you could read the newspaper, then who cares? Mm. But, you know, then you have, you know, the password reset questions. We've already seen time and time and time again where the attackers are able to work out the reset questions, right? And in some cases, like with Firehost, which is an excellent provider, they let you set your own password, you know, to talk to a telephone representative over the phone or to access, you know, the system directly over the internet. But they always allow you to reset that password. So now it all depends on your email. So now the weak link could be your email. So let's say you're with Yahoo or live.com or Gmail, then your security is you're totally reliant on your email provider. So myself, I have several accounts with several different organizations. And if somebody is able to compromise my email, right, through, you know, hacking, you know, whatever email provider I'm with, then, you know, then they compromise me. So
they get everything. I mean, once they've got your email, they can just password reset everything, because everyone uses their email ID like as their login ID, which I've just always thought is crackheaded. Because, you know, like a username and a password is kind of two factors, right? But an email address, you've got to assume, is known information. So why the hell we're using it as a login name is, you know, beyond me. Hey, I just wanted to float one idea by you, though. You know, in a smartphone age, you would have thought that it might make sense for the telcos to provide their customers with some sort of soft token application, maybe, that they could use to verify. But I guess, you know, a way around that is to just say, I lost my phone, I need you to reprovision my SIM, right? So it doesn't really get you anywhere, does it?
Yeah, the attacker, you're going to analyze the process, right? So you want to compromise Matt Hogan, you want to wipe his Mac, you want to wipe his iPhone. So, you know, how can I get to his, you know, Apple ID? And then you figure, oh, I need his last four digits of his credit card. Well, there are a number of ways to get that, right? It's not just the simple way, the Amazon way. There are a number of ways, you know, run the guy's credit report. I mean, it's not that hard. I mean, years ago, you used to be able to find Experian access codes in the trash, right? Mm. So, you know, and probably compromising the credit bureaus isn't that difficult, because so many people have access to it. Every car dealership does, if you want to purchase a car, for example, in America. So it's really not that hard. So the process is, so then the attacker simply, okay, so just got to get the last four digits of the credit card. So the attacker is always looking for the weakest link.
Yeah.
And the weakest link, as we just discussed, is the email, right? It's really researching what is the processes of your target company, and then finding out and then working out how to exploit it. It's not difficult.
I think the problem that you're defining here is that any sort of security procedure based on, you know, someone providing static information in order to verify their identity is inherently flawed. I mean, that's really where we've arrived at with this conversation, isn't it?
Right. And then there's, you know, difficult level, right? So, you know, to hack into a telco provider is, it's going to require a sophisticated individual. So is that a reasonable level of security for your business? If it is, then you can rely on it. You can rely on out-of-band services. I forgot the...
But I mean, they don't have to hack in. They can just have the phone number redirected to a voicemail box in their control and then initiate some sort of account reset, stuff like that.
Right, but don't forget, they're either going to have to social engineer somebody or they're going to have to get, you know, access to the back-end
system.
Well,
I guess I'm talking about this in the case of social engineering, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, again, it all depends on the process. Usually, what I found, you know, through my social engineering pen testing is that pretty much all the processes are easily to defeat. I recently had one client, you know, I can't mention the name of the client. They basically allowed employees to reset their password over the internet, including, you know, domain and enterprise admins. And all you really needed to know was either their email address or their login name. And it told you the format of their login name, and you needed the last four digits of the person's social security number and their zip code. Well, you know, it took me about, you know, 30 seconds to exploit that. I mean, and this was for a major company, right? So people are these businesses are relying on very weak processes for remote authentication. And then if they have a strong upfront process, the process to reset the passwords are weak or rely on other companies like the telco provider or your email provider, which is another weak link.
One thing that I thought might actually work, and some of the banks do this, I mean, when they're trying to verify you, they might ask you a few questions about where you last used your credit card. Surely a telephone provider could look back through, you know, where calls were made and say, hey, you know, 2 weeks ago, you took a trip somewhere. Where was it? You know, I mean, is it possible to, you know, put those sorts of questions into, verification script to bolster the process?
Yeah, that's exactly what credit bureaus do and banks do. Is a lot of times my bank, it's kind of funny, my bank, I'll ask, they'll say, okay, you know, I think it was an airline. They go, where did you fly last? And I fly all the time.
Yeah.
Where did you fly on this date? Where did you fly? I think it was Southwest or something. Where did you fly on like July 24th, you know, 1962? Like, huh?
Yeah.
I don't remember. And then what happens is when you can't remember that the answer to that question because of customer service, then they'll ask you an easier question.
So they always fall back, don't they?
They always fall back. Like even businesses that, you know, have customers that set passwords for their account, some banks, if you forget the password, will actually revert to your social security number, which I find, mind-boggling. Like, that's exactly what you don't want to happen. No, but I do agree that, you know, like the phone company and people that have access to your electronic accounts, like banks, you know, the phone company, you know, I don't know about your email provider. They're going to say, well, who did you email? Or do you recognize these email addresses, you know, that you've emailed in the last month? You know, I guess they could build that into process. And I believe it is a stronger, you know, a stronger way to authenticate somebody. But I haven't seen it to date. I've rarely seen it put into practice because it becomes too complex and not user friendly. Because don't forget, all these businesses want to be extremely customer friendly and they don't want to turn away business.
But could it get to the point where it will actually start hurting them if their accounts, you know, if there's all these horror stories about consumer accounts getting compromised, surely they have to.
Yeah, you think they're going to have to do something. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm sure, you know, Amazon and Apple, you know, definitely had meetings about the Matt Hogan case.
Mm.
Right. And, you know, I have to give it some more thought. I think it all goes to what level of authentication is reasonable for the business. And you have to meet whatever you have to raise the bar to that level. In some cases, it might be, you know, simply a password reset to your email address, or in some cases, it might just be asking you the last four digits of your social. And then in some cases, it requires, well, who did you know somebody in New Zealand? You know, who is it, or when did you call that person, or can you give me part of their phone number?
Yeah.
You know? But even for your credit report, and your credit report is supposed to be the most sensitive piece of information, the bureaus, to verify your identity, simply ask you information that's on your credit report, and then it is easy to gain access to that information. It is not hard at all.
Mm. All right, well, that's all very interesting stuff, Kevin, and it looks like this is an area that some thought is going to have to go into. Thanks a lot for taking some time out of your schedule to have a chat to us on Risky Business.
Hey, thank you, Patrick. Have a great day.
Kevin Mitnick there with a look at social engineering in the 21st century. And you got to love how I was calling Matt Honan Matt Hannon, and Kevin kept calling him Matt Hogan. So sorry, Matt, if you're listening, but we just couldn't seem to get your name right there. And it's always good to catch up with Mr. Mitnick. I've actually known a lot of our regular interviewees for quite a long time now. I actually remember taking Kevin bushwalking in a fairly secret spot up here in the Northern Rivers of New South Wales once about 8 years ago. It was a 45-minute trek through regenerated rainforest to to this beautiful watering hole and a little waterfall and stuff. And I very nearly got us lost on the way back as the sun was going down. Now, I played it pretty calm. But Kevin, if you're listening, yes, I really did lose the trail and pretend that I didn't. And we very nearly did sleep out there with the leeches. So I feel enough time has passed that I can tell you this. Not the capable Bear Grylls style Australian bushmaster I was making out to be. But I'm glad no one panicked. Anyway, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Michael Baker, who is the co-founder and chief technology officer of Packet Loop. Packet Loop is an Australian startup that does what it calls big data security analytics. Basically, you send them packet captures from your network, and you can use their software to do all sorts of visualizations and analysis in the cloud. There's also a nice little feature in there relating to security, which is Packet Loop will run your network data through multiple IPSs at a regular interval, which means if you've been hosed by a previously undetectable attack, when a signature for that attack becomes available, you'll have a decent shot at actually knowing about it. So it's a way to figure out, hey, this box got owned 2 months ago by a threat that we've only just figured out how to identify. Now, these guys are in their beta phase, but they're ready to start raising awareness about what they're doing, hence why they're on the show this week. And they're sponsoring our coverage of RuxCon Breakpoint next week, so you'll be able to retrieve all of our coverage at risky.biz/breakpoint. Anyway, I started off by asking Michael how big the average captures these guys deal with is. Isn't a packet dump for any significant amount of time just too big to ship off over the net anyway? And here's what Michael had to say.
Well, to give you an idea, it is a lot of data. And when you think we've got a customer we're working with prior to launch, and 3 terabytes of captures was 6 weeks of their traffic in and out of their entire network, and they've got about 100 megabit link. So, you know, although 100 megabit could be about a terabyte a day, 6 weeks for them was about 3 terabytes.
That's not really too bad when you think about it, is it?
Not really. And then when you think about how cheap it is to store 3 terabytes, you know, you can pretty much go to a local computer shop and buy 3 terabytes for, I think they're about $100 or less now.
So, I mean, where are you actually getting your capture? I mean, do you want captures that just go through the gateway, or are you looking at internal stuff as well on a network, looking for lateral movement and things like that? Or are you really just looking at what's coming in and going out of the gateway?
There can be anything that someone's interested in analyzing or getting more intelligence out of. So, right now, I suppose we're doing a lot more testing on gateway or internet-facing type captures, but eventually I would assume internal captures would be part and process as well.
I would imagine there are some compliance issues involved here because, you know, you would think that your packet captures would hold some sort of sensitive information, some sort of proprietary information, and handing that off to a third party might be problematic. How is it that you guys are getting around that? You know, I mean, I would imagine it would make many potential customers nervous.
Well, look, I think initially there's going to be a lot of inertia with storing this kind of information in the cloud. But I suppose if you look at what's already being stored in the cloud, you've got things like email, documents and files, accounts and financial information, device logs, credit cards. You know, there's a lot of information that's already stored in the cloud. I suppose more to your point, we're advocating the creation of a new data source, which is full packet captures. And I believe, you know, I'm not trying to make the decision for the customer. All I can do is offer them a kind of value proposition and a series of mitigations. And if they like the idea of it, then they can take advantage of it. You know, they can choose their own level of involvement.
So, I mean, but is there a way for you guys to get involved when people haven't shipped off the packet captures? I mean, can you then, you know, just go onto their network and actually do analytics on their own local data store? Or does everything have to be in the cloud with you guys?
No, you're right. We have the cloud solution, which is, you know, anyone can upload, we can process anyone's data in the cloud, et cetera. But we also have an on-premise solution that we're working on. That'll follow the cloud solution I would say by about three to four months. So right. In that scenario, we ship all of the software and systems to your site and you process captures on site. And we've already had some interest in that, you know, just for the fact, like you said, there are some organizations with a risk profile so high, they will never, ever want to ship any kind of internal data to external providers.
Yeah, no, I can really, I can understand from the limited experience that I've had dealing with enterprise-y folk. Yeah, I can't imagine too many of them being absolutely thrilled about shipping this stuff off, you know, externally. But I mean, why don't you, we know the basic idea, which is you basically IDS these PCAPs, you know, these packet captures, to see if anything has gone wrong. And, you know, as the signatures are updated and, you know, there's new detection methods uncovered, you might discover something that happened 3 months ago. I mean, that is the general idea, right?
Well, that's part of the product, yeah. So the idea or where the name came from of looping the traffic and continuously looping the traffic as signature-based technologies update, yes, we find or hope to find zero-day attacks in old traffic. And I suppose the benefits of then finding that are quite substantial. So they're worth looking for, with regards to being able to identify potentially who the attacker was, what stage of their attack were they at when they used the zero day. Every single session from then on from that IP address or that country or that city, we can go and further analyze. So it gives us a kind of point in time to really start analyzing a breach or an attack.
Now, what are you actually competing with? I would imagine that a lot of these sort of, you know, supposed APT detection boxes, you know, stuff like NetWitness, Dambala, FireEye. I mean, is that where your competition's coming from, or is it, or are there other companies that are sort of similar to yours in that, you know, will take your logs and analyze them externally?
Well, I think a lot of people are doing things like storing. So you look at Endace, and I think there's a couple of other companies that do similar things with regards to, you know, gigabit or 10 gigabit storage. There's not a lot of people doing MapReduce cloud-based processing, and there's not a lot of people doing the visual analytics, and that's probably the core of the product. So although today we're really talking about the idea of looping traffic to find zero days, the real core of the product is the ability to, I suppose, explore your data set. Using kind of rich visualizations and analytics, and that's really where we focus the product. So, yeah, when we talk to people in our own industry, we're most likened to like a NetWitness in the cloud, but I suppose we see ourselves as a bit different to NetWitness.
So, did you build your own GUI, or did you customize it from something like Multigo?
No, everything is built from scratch. We started the project around about 18 months ago. And everything with regards to the GUI, the visualizations, the dashboards, the data panels is all built from scratch.
And when are you guys launching?
We're looking to launch hopefully before Christmas. We're at an early access stage at the moment where we've got about 10 early adopters on the platform. We'll go through a private beta stage and then hopefully commercial before the end of the year. You know, that's our target. So where we're at the moment is we're shipping the threats module, which is everything to do with, indicators and warnings that we get when we fire that traffic through the multiple IPS. And then I suppose from there, we'll deliver the rest of the platform, which is there's one area for analysis, areas for analyzing sessions, protocols, files, and all sorts of things that go through your network. But threats, we're going to ship first.
So if there are any CSOs out there listening who, you know, especially those located in Australia who might be interested in meeting with you guys and, actually trying this stuff out, I mean, are you at the point now where you can enlist some of these private betas or not so much?
Yeah, definitely. You know, if anyone's got some data that they're looking to analyze or looking to get on with this technology early, then sure, contact us and we'll start working with you now.
Now, I understand also you're presenting at RuxCon next weekend after this one.
That's right, yeah. We're running a session or a kind of follow-on session to what I ran at Black Hat Europe earlier this year called Finding Needles in Haystacks, the Size of Countries. And it's really, I suppose, showing you using open source tools or an open source platform that, that we've developed how you can take advantage of full packet captures and analysing them.
All righty. Well, I guess I'm going to see you there. I'll also see you down at Breakpoint. Michael Baker, thank you very much for taking some time out to chat to us on Risky Business.
Thanks for having me, Patrick.
My Michael Baker of Packet Loop there, and just head over to packetloop.com to sign up for the beta, or beta, as our American friends like to say. And that is it for this week's show. Next week's edition will be brought to you from the floor of the Breakpoint Security Conference in Melbourne. After that, I'm heading off to RuxCon for the weekend, which is also in Melbourne. So I guess I'm going to see a lot of you guys down there over the next couple of weeks. And I'm really looking forward to it. Now, this week's track is by the Izzy's, Country Music Alert. It's called Change Your Mind. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.